We are here on this glorious Friday afternoon in the middle of July, wishing, hoping, praying that summer will actually begin out here in Washington. It's kind of sort of summerish today, but somebody sent me a graphic yesterday that said, your summer has failed to install. Please reboot. We're here today with Stephen Gradonis, Deacon Stephen Gradonis, in fact. We're on this, man, this has been an eventful week or so here in American and world history. Just Dallas last week, and yesterday was the terrible attack in Nice. And there's apparently, while as we speak, there is a coup going on in Turkey. And the military have declared victory. Who knows what that means? But it looks like Erdogan is the guy's name in Turkey, the president in Turkey. It looks like he's out now and someone else is taking over. No one knows what that means yet. How's it going, Steve?
For me, it's going swell.
Good.
You know, nope. My town has not been hit by any terrorist attacks, and police in my town have not been shot and killed.
That's
and,
good.
Yeah, and I'm not living through a coup d'etat. So for me personally, everything is going great. You know, one of the things that I've been doing as a deacon concerns the general intercessions or the universal prayer, which is meant to address the needs of the church, the Catholic Church, the local mm-hmm. community. We usually pray for our bishop and for other clergy, and you know, you pray for the sick and for the dead and for other particular needs. And when there are extraordinary needs in the culture or in the world at large, you know, when something extraordinary happens, we try to include that. And so last week, I went out to the church before the Saturday vigil mass to make sure that there was an intercession regarding the violence in Dallas and elsewhere. And earlier today, I sent new petition to someone from our church to make sure that it was included this weekend regarding the terror attack in Nice. And, you know, now before Friday has even ended, we also have this situation in Turkey. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. You just, I told, I was talking about this with Rod Bennett last week, and I was saying it feels it. You weren't around then, but it feels like 1968 to me. It has that same sense that of instability and so forth, which of course makes people feel afraid. And yet, we're assured by our faith that God is still in charge. This is the story has not gotten away from him. He's not scrambling to keep up and, you know, wondering what's going to happen next. This is God is God remains God. So, you know, the counsel of the faith is still and especially at such hours, do not worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself. God sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. But that's, you know, you still, we prayed today at Mass for the people of France and for Nice. This is before I knew about what was going on in Turkey. But, you know, the thing about the attack in Nice.
Yes.
Is, you were mentioning this, it's, the guy seems to have just been some kind of rootless loser. His, you know, his marriage fell apart, and yeah, he was some kind of Muslim, but not one that seems to really care about Islam especially. It was like, this will bring order to my life if I go out in this final, you know,
way. Well, and that's the thing, you know, I think that a lot of anti-Islamic jihad conservative Western types feel that you're somehow subverting the narrative or that you're playing apologist if you say, well, maybe this guy wasn't a jihadist. But yeah. In a way, it's actually scarier to me if he, as it looks like, that he wasn't a jihadist than if he were. You know, I mean, as somebody pointed out to me on Twitter, Islamism is not the only ideology in the world that makes people blow things up and kill large numbers of people. And the example that they cited was Timothy McVeigh. And what I said was, okay, but McVeigh was a hardcore, sold out, committed nut job who, you know, he was all about his ideology. And I can understand someone who has that kind of relationship with a perverse worldview going out like that. But here we have somebody whose issues were of the kind that you normally associate with someone who turns to drugs and alcohol, or perhaps commits suicide, or perhaps even takes out family members with him in a murder suicide, goes and shoots up their workplace, something like that. But this guy had, this is, now I'm only speculating here, we don't know this, but it seems like there was this template there for him. You know, that radical Islam has put this idea out there, and it's put these images of mass destruction, and this is a way of, as you said, it's a way of putting some kind of order or structure or meaning to a life which he probably felt pretty bad about, and that to me is a very frightening thing.
Yeah. I mean, he strikes me as more like a kind of Islamic Lee Harvey Oswald, more than anything, just some guy who just, you know, his life sucked and so he's, I'm just going to do this thing, you know. Although, you know, at the same time, of course, I look at, you know, so where do you get all those explosives in France? That suggests to me that he may have had help. And of course, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are looking to connect with exactly people like him. You seem like you're ticked off and you're willing to do something desperate. Here, we'll help you, you know. And so that's it's still entirely possible that this is part of a, you know, a larger thing. The part of what makes it confusing is that ISIS tends to take credit for everything. Mm-hmm. Whether they really had anything to do with it or not, they'll take credit for it anyway.
Well, it serves their ends, yeah.
Right, because it serves their ends. But, you know, the thing is, and it's happening already, so do Western demagogues. So, we've got Newt Gingrich out there saying, what we need to do is administer a religion test for every Muslim in the United States and deport them if they fail this religion test. Well, it's like... Seriously? You know, there's like 3 million Muslims in the United States. How do you plan to administer such a test? You know, and he's got some theory about Sharia, which most Westerners, including me, by the way, don't know anything about Sharia. They have this fear that it's like some sort of secret code or something. That, you know, if you subscribe to Sharia, then that makes you a terrorist.
Right.
Well, okay, if that's the case, then why aren't there 3.3 million acts of terrorism happening on U.S. soil every day?
Well,
because that's how many Muslims there are, you know?
The reality is that Sharia does not mean one thing, according to Islamic scholars, and particularly according to very good Christian scholars of Islam. Sharia, there are several different schools of Sharia, at least four in the Sunni tradition and then one other in the Shia tradition as well. Right. And they range from, you know, more conservative to more liberal, and whether they focus only on the earliest sources or whether they include later legal sources and opinions and so forth.
Right.
And you can't... you have recognized Sharia courts in the state of Israel, for goodness sake.
Right. Yeah, and what they don't mean is, you know, the secret law with which Muslims plan to replace the Constitution. That's not what it means. You know, it's like saying canon law is the Catholic plot to replace the Constitution. That's not how this works. And so you've got to read people running around and this whole notion that of freedom of religion for me, but not for thee. My question is, if we start kicking people out of the United States because they subscribe to some form of Sharia, and which one, by the way, and to what ends? How soon until we start kicking people out of the U.S. for subscribing to the Ten Commandments or to canon law? And so this whole reaction of fear really plays into exactly what ISIS wants to do. What ISIS desperately wants to do is get the West to believe that, yes, all Muslims are us.
Right, exactly.
And then isolate Muslims within their own society and then... You know, if you want to create radicalized, especially young Muslims, that's the way to do it. You know, yeah,
the whole.
We'll continue with this conversation when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we'll be back right after this.
Listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Hello. Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Steve Gradonis, Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We're talking a little bit about the violence that we saw in Nice yesterday, and we will, alas, you know that we'll see more of it too. But I think the dumbest response that we can make to it is with this whole, we have to deport all the Muslims. We have to what we need to do is burn the First Amendment for Muslims. The whole strategy that ISIS uses, its entire strategy, is to get Westerners to subscribe to what ISIS says about itself, which is we're the true Muslims. There is no such thing. How should you put it? Islam doesn't have a magisterium. There is no one true Muslim. There are as many kinds of, there's lots and lots of different kinds of Muslims and lots of different schools of thought in Islam. And you have two major branches of Islam, Sunni Islam and Shia Islam, and who very often hate each other. Most of the victims of ISIS have been other Muslims. Their stated purpose is to, as they put it, eliminate the gray zone. What they want to do is, their crazy goal is to get all Muslims everywhere to subscribe to the notion that ISIS represents what it really means to be a Muslim, these murderous nut jobs. Way to do that, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get Westerners to treat all Muslims like they're ISIS terrorists, in the hope that those Muslims will say, screw it. If they're going to treat me like this, then I'm going to just go ahead and join ISIS and be a radicalized, crazy nut job. There's always going to be some people that are going to get ticked off and do this. But the dumbest thing that Westerners can do is play along with ISIS and do exactly what they want us to do. This, unfortunately, is the way that some of our more demagogic politicians, namely Donald Trump and most recently Newt Gingrich, have exactly chosen to respond to this. Is what we need to do is we need to single out all Muslims and, you know, submit them to some kind of religious test and et cetera, et cetera. And it's nuts. It's a nutty thing to do, not least, of course, because of, you know, this is the great, that great scene from A Man for All Seasons where Roper, his son-in-law, says, "I would cut down every law in England to get after the devil." And Moore says, "I give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake." Why do we have a First Amendment? We have a First Amendment because today it might be Sharia, you know, but tomorrow it could be the fact that you're a Catholic. It could be it could be the fact that you're a Christian. It could be the fact that you belong to some other religious grouping that whoever is in power decides you need to go. And so this is just the worst way possible to approach this. And, I don't know what to do about world global terrorism or anything, but we offer prayers for the people of Nice. And so anyway, I'll get off my stump. Sorry about that.
No, the difficulty is, of course, that it's very easy to adopt the Muslims are bad and we just need to get them all approach because there is no other obvious or clear approach. I mean, that's the worst thing that we can do, but it's also the obvious thing to do. And part of the reason for that is, as we were talking about before the break, the success that the Wahhabi and Salafi schools of Islam have had since the 1970s in putting that radical, violent interpretation of Islam out there as the default, definitive interpretation of Islam. And right. Then, you know, even somebody like the killer in Nice, who was not radicalized, apparently, and did not subscribe to these ideologies, that's still out there for a model for him. And so it's there is a certain logic or reasonableness to it, but it is the worst thing that we can do. And it does, in fostering this kind of us versus them thinking, we're harming ourselves, we're harming our democracy, we're harming our free state, we're aiding our enemy, and we are also not incidentally going against the gospel, which calls us to be willing to see the other as our neighbor and to respond right. to their need. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, the whole idea of seeing the other as one's neighbor rather than as one's enemy and as an object of suspicion is something that I was thinking about all last week because, mm-hmm. of course, the Sunday we had the parable of the Good Samaritan. Right. And that was before the racial violence in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily before the earlier incidents in Louisiana and Minnesota, where unarmed black men were one of them was unarmed, mm-hmm. where they were shot by police when at least one of them was clearly trying to comply. And
right.
so, God really hit me over the head that this mm-hmm. was something that I had to talk about. And that's, right. you know, that went into my, my homily, which I posted at the National Catholic Register website.
You know, one of the things that occurs, I don't know if you ever were much of a fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Very, very good writing. Very sharp writing on that show.
Very sharp writing. I mean, there's a
problematic aspect, but
indeed.
Yeah.
But there's a particular character in that show who grows on you as time goes on. His name is Spike. Mm-hmm. And Spike is, he's this guy that he wants to be the Sid Vicious of the vampire world. He wants to be a serious badass. And he has a real violent streak to him and so on and so forth. But of course, as time goes on, you discover that he's really kind of a pussycat, you know, and a romantic and a softy and all of this stuff. Anyway, he gets a chip put in his head by the government at one point that makes it impossible for him to do anything violent toward human beings. And so every time he tries to do anything violent toward a human being, he feels this sharp pain in his head, and it debilitates him, and so on and so forth. Well, anyway, at one point in the series, he gets mad at a fellow vampire for some reason. And so he punches him or does something violent to him, and the chip doesn't go off, and he discovers that he can be as violent as he likes toward other vampires. And so all of a sudden he joins the heroes of the show and wants to be their pals and chums and go out with them. And, you know, and he gives this speech about, yeah, let's do this for Christmas and puppies and, you know, all good and decent things. And all he really wants to do is just go out and beat people up. That's all. He just wants to indulge his rage. The people that he can
beat up, yes.
The people that he can beat up, right? And so he just wants to indulge his rage, but now he's doing it for the good guys because that won't make the chip in his head go off. And I think about that because there is that kind of Hulk smash response to radical, you know, Trump was on the news the other day saying, if this happens, you know, if I was president, I would launch, he says, a world war. Well, what does that even mean, right? A world war, World War II was fought because the whole world got involved in it. All these countries declared war on each other and so on and so forth. And same with World War I. But what do you mean that you would launch a world war? Is it you'd fight radical Islam? Well, we're doing that. So what are you saying? You know, well, it feels satisfying. I'm saying this very angry, outsized, crazy thing because I'm angry at this thing that just happened. Well, the thing is that when you're really angry, you make bad choices. You do dumb things, you know, so what are you saying? Are you saying we should launch nukes at somebody? Who exactly? You know, the source of a lot of radical terrorism, the funding for a lot of it comes from Saudi Arabia. You want to nuke Saudi Arabia? Do you think that would be a good idea?
The underlying impetus that Trump is playing to here is tribalism.
Of course.
And tribalism is the native condition of the human race. Tribalism is right. Not something somehow extremely perverse that we're taught as children. What we're taught as children in our culture shapes the form of our tribalism. But really, we all grow up natively as tribalists. And it doesn't matter if you have a liberal, politically correct, inclusive education. That will just make you tribalist about your liberal, politically correct, inclusive friends.
Right, and exactly.
Other people who don't share your enlightened view are outside the tribe.
They're still other.
Yes,
they're absolutely. Still other. You know, yeah. I want to talk about when we got a little bit of time and then we're up against a break, but when we return, I want to talk about this because I think this is important. I want to talk about the gospel distinction between respect for the family and the love of the community when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Stephen Gradonis, and we will be back right after this.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Hello and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. I wanted to touch on something before we go on. We were talking a little bit about the significance of the family, and there's something interesting that comes that was pointed out to me by a friend of mine, which I had never really seen. One of the things that I've insisted on for a long time is that if you want to understand Catholic social teaching, one really good way of understanding it, of something that unlocks an awful lot of it, is if it's good for the family, it's good. And if it's bad for the family, it's bad. A huge amount of Catholic social teaching can practically be summarized that way. And so a lot of things that people, you know, find so baffling about Catholic social teaching, if you just look at it through that grid, you go, oh, now it makes sense. So why is abortion bad? Abortion's bad because killing children is bad, and killing children harms the family. Why does the church teach what it teaches about a living wage? Well, because families need a living wage in order to survive. And if you don't have a living wage, you harm the family, and that's bad. And, you know, why does the church say this and that and the other thing? Well, because the family is so important. And so it's easy to kind of, and particularly in our day and age when the family is under such attack, not surprisingly then, huge amounts of our resources are devoted simply to arguing for the goodness of the family and the preservation of the family, because the family is the building block of civilization. When you destroy the family, you've destroyed a civilization. But the thing is, and this was pointed out to me by a friend, all of that is true. And yet, here's the thing. Building blocks are for building. And so merely preserving the family is not enough in the gospel understanding, because there is something that transcends the family. And Jesus makes this very clear. Who is my mother, my sister, my brother, the one who does the will of my Father in heaven? And he'll even go on to say scandalous things, especially in ancient Judaism, scandalous things about the family, that members, a man's enemies will be the members of his own household, that I come not to bring peace, but a sword, that, the gospel is going to set mother against son and father against daughter, and you know, and so on and so forth. And so what my friend was pointing out to me was simply that in Jesus's teaching, it's the community ultimately that transcends the family, the body of Christ, and also the in a certain way, the human community, because the body of Christ is here to save that human community. And that's a really startling thing, I think, for a lot of Americans to realize, because, you know, if you're a family values conservative, it's so important. You put such a premium on the family because it's under such attack. And yet it's true. Building blocks are for building. And so there is something that transcends the family, the good of the family. And I think that's important for us to think about, because we can get involved in a kind of idolatry of the besieged, if you will. You see something precious that's being threatened, and you can pour so many resources into protecting that thing, you can forget that that thing is not the ultimate thing, because it's such an important thing.
I think it's really important to understand this from a theological perspective, from a supernatural perspective. On the natural level, the human family is very important, and with the principle of subsidiarity, places the smaller community at the center, and the larger community is really meant to be at the service of the smaller community. So we have villages and towns and cities and states and countries, for each for the sake of the community which is lower down on the rung and which is thus more real and more directly ordered toward the good of its members, with the family being at the lowest level and therefore the most important. But Jesus calls us supernaturally to transcend that orientation. And in Israel, there was an ethic that went beyond the family, which was love thy neighbor. And mm-hmm. your neighbor was your fellow countryman. He was one who shared your culture and your religion usually, or he was the foreigner or the alien who had settled in your area and was thus regarded as being within the scope of charity. And mm-hmm. and so that was your neighbor. And Jesus made two moves. First of all, he reorganized the idea of family around the family of God, which is the body of Christ, the church. So there is in Christianity a brotherhood which extends to all of those that are in Christ and which transcends family obligations. And Jesus expresses this in some really shocking terms.
Yes.
Telling people that they must hate their father and mother and even let the dead bury their dead. Go and preach the gospel.
Oh, yeah.
Utterly.
I mean, I always tell people, if you want to get a sense for how that sounded to the ears that first heard it, just imagine those words being spoken by Reverend Sun Myung Moon to your daughter.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it was a very, very shocking thing to say.
So Jesus expands the idea of brotherhood, but he doesn't make it universal to the whole human race. This is something that Cardinal Ratzinger, Father Benedict, formerly Pope Benedict the 16th, points out in his book on the meaning of Christian brotherhood, that Jesus does teach a universal brotherhood, but not one that is universal to all of mankind, but that one is universal to all those who are in Christ. Mm-hmm. So it's this brotherhood in Christ that is the brotherhood that matters most. What he also does, though, is he extends the concept of neighbor to anyone who is in need, anyone that I can help, anyone to whom circumstances give me some kind of debt of obligation. And that includes the stranger and the alien. It includes people who I would normally regard as being my enemy. And this is what was really shocking about the parable of the Good Samaritan, is that Samaritans were the enemy. They were heretics and half heathens. And I am not, I promise you, the only homilist this week who suggested that if Jesus were telling this homily or telling this parable today, that he might have told the parable of the good Muslim, or the parable, depending on what neighborhood you were in, it might be the parable of the good undocumented Latino. Jesus is trying to get his hearers to expand the scope of their charity and to recognize that, you know, not to identify people primarily with these groups, but to see each other as human beings created in God's image.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and it was a shocking, and, you know, to get a sense of how shocking it was, one need only read the end of Jesus's story. Although it's notable, that, you know, because one of the things that, one of the sort of caricatures I think that a lot of moderns have, is the idea that, you know, the Jews in the gospel are just utterly insular people who, you know, you get this, you know, I've heard this kind of stuff said. I once heard in not the worst homily I've ever heard in the Archdiocese of Seattle, but it's up there in the top three, I think. I once was on a scouting trip with a bunch of guys, and we were off on the Olympic Peninsula somewhere, and we needed to get to Mass, so we just stopped at whatever the local parish was. And the reading that day was the story of Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman. And you know the story where she comes to him and asks for him to heal her daughter, and he says, he tells her that it's not right to give what is meant for the family to the dogs. This was a common Jewish slang term to refer to, you know, the Gentiles who lived in the area. They called them dogs. And she comes back with a response and says, well, even the dogs get, you know, the table scrapings. And he says, "You woman, you have great faith. Your daughter is healed." And so the guy that was giving the homily said that, you see, even Jesus had to struggle with his racism. Shut up, stop, you know. But yeah, that was the homily, was how Jesus had to struggle with his racism. We'll return to this when we get back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we'll be back with Deacon Stephen Gardonis right after this.
For listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Mark Shea, we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis. I just want to finish up the point that I was making, which was not actually about Jesus being a racist, because come on, you know, conceived without, born without sin, you know, the whole thing. But rather, what's intriguing to me is that Jesus's habit of hanging around with the wrong people. So prostitutes, tax collectors, but also Gentiles. He talked to Roman centurions. He healed Gentiles as well as Jews. This was not used in evidence against him at his trial, but it was clearly part of a whole constellation of things about him. It was the sort of thing that those who hated him said, there's just something about him, when they couldn't actually bring a legal charge. Because, of course, the law of Israel said, you shall love your neighbor. This is not something that Jesus invented. He's quoting the law of Israel when it says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And neighbors meant Gentiles as well as Jews. So that couldn't be brought in evidence against him. But it was certainly one of those things that his enemies looked at and regarded as substantiation for the main charges. So anyway, I mentioned that you know what you're talking about. Tribalism it's just as old as the human race. It's just part of what we bring to the package.
And something that is not, you know, purely socially constructed. It's part of human nature, but it is something that we are called by the gospel to transcend.
Absolutely. So let's talk about movies. See any good movies?
Let's not talk about movies, because I have something else I want to talk about.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. We've had such a downer of an hour talking about all of the world's troubles over the last 2 weeks. I want to talk about an inspiring story. Okay. It's a crazy story, but one that people have responded to very positively since I shared it.
Okay.
It's a story that sounds a little bit like a legend that you might read about in the lives of the saints from the early Middle Ages or even from the patristic period. There is a man who enters a monastery, but he gets sick, he contracts tuberculosis, and he is expelled from the monastery. And while he's lying on his sickbed, he takes a vow to the Blessed Virgin that if he recovers, he will raise a shrine in her honor.
Hmm.
And he does recover, and he starts to build on the feast day of Our Lady of the Pillar, October the 12th. And he continues building, and he builds for years, and years turn into decades, and decades stretch to half a century, and he keeps building by hand with recycled or donated materials, and he raises the most amazing house of worship. He calls it a cathedral. And like I say, this sounds like something out of a legend, but it's actually happening right now. In Spain, about a dozen miles from Madrid, there is a former Trappist who is 90 years old. His name is Justo Gallego Martinez. Locals call him Justo or Don Justo. And he is still working every day on his cathedral. He has an assistant who's been helping him for the last 20 years with the heavy lifting, but he really built most of it by hand. And you have to go online to my blog at the Register and watch this little video of his cathedral just to see what incredible beauty this man has done, mostly, as I say, with his own two hands.
Hmm.
And it raises all kinds of questions because his cathedral is not associated with the local diocese and the church hasn't endorsed it and it's not quite finished and he could die any day. And there's no indication as to what is going to happen when he dies. The diocese says, you know, they don't have enough church-going Catholics in Spain to fill the churches that they have. They don't need to take on the additional expense and investment, you know, to finish this cathedral. Nobody can tell me that Mass has ever been said here or will ever be said. And so you have to wonder on some level, mm-hmm. has this man wasted his life? Is he perhaps mentally ill? You know, but at the same time, I think how many writers, artists, composers have spent their lives in pursuit of their passion with less to show for it than this man has? And I think too about the idea of a radical life. Say a life of celibacy or of consecrated religious life. We say in Catholic theology that these kinds of lives have what is called an eschatological sign value. And what that basically means is nobody would choose this if they were thinking only of this world.
Right.
So there are things that make no sense in this world. And you think of a cathedral. A cathedral, of course, points to heaven. Well, yeah. What cathedral points to heaven more than a cathedral in which very likely Catholics may never gather to say Mass that was made purely as an expression of someone's faith, of his relationship with God? Here's a man who's making something beautiful for God, and it may never be anything than that. And if that's all that it is, I think it's something really inspiring and amazing.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I love that idea, too, of my friend Sherry Waddell has said that Christians should live their lives in a way that is inexplicable without Christ, and that's you know that's what this man has done. Is
absolutely
he's done something that really is inexplicable apart from his conviction. That he is honoring God by this act. You want there to be some kind of Frank Capra conclusion to a story like this, you know, where the bishop comes riding in and says, this fills me with awe, you know, and consecrates it on the spot with some holy water and celebrates a mass right there. You just want to see something like that happen, because it's just, what a glorious way to spend a life. You know, that's one of the things that the Catholic tradition has done, is it keeps leaving all these legacies around for people to look at long after the builders. You know, the cathedrals are these great monuments at the faith of all these nameless people who built these amazing things, you know, and they just did it for love. So there's something that I was talking to a friend today who, she's an atheist who is very empathetic to the faith.
We've talked about her before.
Yeah, and one of the things we started talking about, Dorothy Day, it was a, you know, very left-wing Catholic, but at the same time, she had views which are hard to reconcile a lot of times for leftish people to reconcile with being left. So that, you know, there's often this, you know, why were these things not sold and the money given to the poor kind of approach to these, you know, great Catholic art treasures and so on and so forth. And Dorothy Day's response to it was absolutely, churches should be gorgeous and liturgies should be gorgeous. And her argument was very simple. She said, you sell that stuff off, where does it go? It winds up in some rich guy's private art collection. You leave it where it is, and any hobo off the street can walk into St. Peter's and see things that will lift his mind to heaven. You know, any homeless guy on a New York street can walk into St. Patrick's and see things he could never see otherwise. And so she was adamant that cathedrals, churches should be beautiful. Because they, first of all, because it honored God, but second of all, because it made beauty accessible to the poor. And I never forgot that. I always thought that was a very beautiful insight, that those kinds of expressions of love made public, make God visible for everybody, for anybody.
I want to read something.
Afford a ticket. Yeah.
That a friend of mine wrote in response to this, and I wrote this in my blog post. He writes, an act like this is beautiful in its apparent irrationality, in its defiance of all conventional logic. It's a work of spectacular, breathtaking madness. But at some point, true love always demands some level of madness. And he goes on to say, of all the glorious cathedrals in all the magnificent world, this may be the greatest. Really, I think if you're listening right now and you go to my blog at the National Catholic Register and you watch this video, you won't be sorry. It's really an amazing thing.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for sharing it. I love that. It's just a glorious, glorious thing. And there's, you know, it's funny. There's so many of those things out there when you start looking for them, you know, little and big, you know, acts of devotion, simple things that have been done by people, you know, it's dark matter. It's stuff that doesn't often make the headlines, but it's all over the place. Deacon Stephen Gradonis, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer was Ethan Bolin, and I'll be back on Monday with Simca Fisher. Until then, have a fantastic weekend.